Think of all the books that have shaped who you are. Now, let's advance the conversation. In this podcast, I'll dig into topics that affect how you see the world by talking with authors who write about them. This is Cap Radio Reads. I'm Donna Epidone. Today, you'll hear my conversation with Lan Cao and Harlan Margaret Van Cao, co-authors of Family in Six Tones. The trauma of war stays long after the fighting ends. Author Lan Cao was a child during the Vietnam War. Her experience continued to simmer under the surface, even after she became a successful attorney and author in the U.S. This memoir, written with her teenage daughter, Harlan, explains the long-term effects of emotional trauma in their family. If their story sounds familiar, it may be because they were on NPR's StoryCorps in 2018 to mark the 50th anniversary of the Tet Offensive.
So in 2018, the interview ran. The interview was done actually several years before that, but they took it out of the archives and ran it in 2018. And it was a collaborative format where Harlan asked me questions. And it just so happened that it ran in the morning of NPR, in the NPR show, and my publisher heard it. I never told her about it. My editor heard it, but the publisher heard it too. And they approached us. They thought it was really a very interesting format to have a mother-daughter write a joint memoir simultaneously rather than one in which the child becomes an adult and reflects back on her relationship with her mom. So in that sense, the interactive collaborative format in the present tense was what they were interested in. So they approached us to do a memoir. And I asked Harlan, do you want to do it? And she said, yes. So it was brand new territory for me.
For both of you. Harlan, you were young at the time. You were in high school, right, when this process started?
Yeah, I was about 15. I was just going to turn 16. So at the time, I thought I knew everything. But I think when you're 15, you have like a very naive view, even if you're kind of pessimistic. Somehow you're both naive and pessimistic. So I was very excited. I didn't think there would be any trouble. I was like, totally, yes. She was like, well, we should think about it. They're giving us a week. And I was like, no, you can just say yes now. But she was more hesitant. I think it showed the difference in our personalities. I have always been really extroverted. And the only concern I had really, though, was just that, you know, it's a memoir. And I did want to write, but it's not what I was expecting when you're so young to write a memoir.
Well, did they give you any guidelines to work with? Or did they just say, go for it?
Well, because we had gotten their attention from an interview that was about the Vietnamese War. So their hopes were that it would be war themed. But I think because it happened to fall around the time where I'm growing up, 15, 16, it would have inevitably become like a coming of age story too. So we kind of worked that in. So they would kind of give us pointers, exactly what they wanted, what theme they wanted. There was some concerns about, you know, I'm going to obviously be able to write chronologically because that's like 16 years worth, but she has to talk about the war in the past and also follow me and raising me. So those were kind of the guidelines, but it was up to us, which I was very surprised. It was kind of like they were saying, you know, we're interested, but you still have to kind of show that you can do it. So we wrote an outline together of what chapter one, Harlan will say this, this and that. And we did stray sometimes. But it was always natural. Like it was never like a dramatic, like we've decided, it just kind of happened and they worked with us.
The guidelines were basically keep everything within a rotation of themes. So war, migration, being a refugee, mother-daughter relationship within that context, and how the mother-daughter relationship was affected by the past that I brought into the relationship, whether consciously or unconsciously. So that was their guidance. And we stayed within that, but when you write, you never really just follow the recipe.
Well, that's true. That's true. And we'll talk about some of the effects intentionally or unintentionally, as you mentioned that. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Was it fun to write together?
No. I have to be honest and say, no, it wasn't fun. You know, writing is never really fun for me, even writing by myself. I wrote two novels, and I'm all, especially creative writing is not necessarily fun for me, but it was extra hard to do it with another person. And we went through various periods where I wanted to pull out, and we had to bring my literary agent, Ellen, into, I didn't want to involve the publisher in this kind of private tug of war between us. So Ellen came and basically mediated between us because we had different ideas about what to write.
I was getting emails from her in the same house because we weren't talking. So I would be up in my room and we would have gone into a big fight. She would have emailed her thoughts and I would have to answer. And it was interesting because I think when we would look at each other's work to begin with, because that's what you would naturally think you would do, is kind of like look at each other's work if you're working together. It's very difficult to give like objective tips and say like, well, it might be better this way or the reader might prefer it this way when you're focused on the fact that they're writing something about you that you totally disagree with. I mean, I'm sure that would happen anyway. You know, your view of yourself is totally different. Your view of your mother or your daughter, it changes. And I always had issues because writing from age 15 to 17 is so different than even writing from like 32 to 35. I always say, because I think your view of life totally changes. You mature in different ways. You take two steps back, one step forward, whatever. And it's very hard for me because I never wanted to regret anything that I was writing. But at the same time, because I didn't want to think like that was my immature view and now I'm embarrassed that it's out there. But at the same time, you have to be very considerate of the other person's preferences, what they want, because the book is literally people have to read it and they have to like it because of how you write, but also because like it's your story. So like you have to be yourself. So that's why we would get into arguments. But then after that, it worked out not looking at each other's stuff anyway, which was really a pleasant surprise.
We changed our writing process completely and it worked much better.
And it worked better. Yeah. Even not communicating, it worked.
I want to talk a little bit about Lon's background before we get into the next piece of this, just so that we understand how you came to this. Now, you are an experienced writer. You had written a couple of books before this one. So we already knew your style. You have this wonderful way of stepping back from a situation and looking at a big picture. So even something that's very personal to you, that might affect you very personally, you still have that ability to stand back and look at it with a different sort of perspective and describe things so beautifully, whether they're emotional and personal to you or not. You have that wonderful way with the language that is very enjoyable to read. Even the sad parts are very enjoyable to read. You had such different upbringings, and I think that difference in perspective is something that makes the book so interesting to read. Lon, you grew up in Vietnam. Can you tell us a little bit about the community that you grew up in?
I grew up in the capital city of Vietnam, actually the twin city of Saigon. So I actually grew up, I say Saigon because most people have not heard of Chalon, which is basically a city right next to Saigon. And you can't really tell when you go from one city to the next, right? It's not like the two cities are pretty much twinned. And the Chalon part, which is where I live, is mostly Chinese, even though we're not ethnic Chinese. And my father was an airborne commander soldier, so we were very immersed in the war. Most of my life was, you know, I was born into the war, but the war was not really fought in Saigon most of the time. It was more in the peripheral perimeters. We would hear gunfire and we would hear explosions. But the only time that the war really entered Saigon, the capital city, was during the Tet Offensive. So that was my first experience, just seeing it very, very close by, you know, door to door, hand to hand combat in my neighborhood.
And I'm not going to ask this to drill you on age, but just so we can understand its overall effects on a young person. How old were you at the time of the Tet Offensive?
Tet Offensive was 1968, so I was
seven.
I was seven.
Okay.
And my family also, I had an uncle who was a Viet Cong, which was on the other side of the war, right? So I grew up with very, very passionate and heated conversations about politics and the differences of the two sides, right? What the South Vietnamese and the Americans were fighting for versus what the Viet Cong were fighting for. So political disagreements were very normal for me at the dinner table. And then in 75, when South Vietnam lost the war, I'm sure many Americans remember the desperate attempts of many South Vietnamese to try to leave. I left because we had a very close American friend who was in Saigon and which had been shot down during the Tet Offensive from his helicopter. And I met him because I volunteered at an army hospital and bonded a lot with him. So he returned to Vietnam to pick me up and adopted me and took me out to live with his family. It wasn't clear whether my parents would make it out. So I grew up in Avon, Connecticut for a few months before my parents came.
Did you know that was going to be your final departure for a while?
No, I think my parents...
You were just visiting?
Yeah, my parents said, oh, it's, you know, you're just going on a trip. And I always, you know, when I found out that Connecticut was in the northern part of the U.S. and that there would be snow, I was thrilled because I remember watching Love Story. Oh. And there were all these snowy scenes at Harvard Square and Cambridge. And every Vietnamese kid loved that movie. And we all carved on our desks, love means never having to say you're sorry, even though we didn't really know what it was. But everybody carved that. So I was dying. Actually, I was very happy to go to Connecticut until I realized that the war was being lost and that I would not return.
Yeah. When you were younger, before you left, still a younger child, you and your mom visited some hospitals in the area, right? So you saw a lot as a kid. Were you able to see joy during your young years in Vietnam? Were you able to have fun, or was it just a constant sense of fear and wondering what was next? How is that for a kid?
Well, it's not just a hospital because, as I said, you know, even though there was no actual fighting in Saigon, it was a paradoxical existence because I did have a regular childhood as well. Like I would play hide and seek and have a normal everyday life, but it was very much punctuated by sort of visuals of war. So sort of the aftermath of the war. It was like seeing an object in the sun, which is very bright, and then there would be a simultaneous shadow that is part of that object, right? So even if you have a very ordinary playful existence, you know, like if it's raining, the kids in Vietnam, in Saigon would run out and play in the rain. So that was very playful. But you would see right away that there were very terrible reminders of war because there were a lot of people who were amputees or all over the city. And that was always a kind of a terrifying thing for me to see it. To see soldiers who had been released from the hospital also with no legs and no arms. And I remember one, I think I described it in my book, of one who sang Creedence Clearwater, one of the most haunting songs for me, something about the rain.
Mm-hmm.
And he would sing it. Yes. He would play it with his feet because he had no arms. For example, one of them. So that was something that was very haunting for me, that kind of double image between a normal existence and something that is not quite normal, but has somehow insinuated itself into normalcy.
Mm-hmm. Coming of age in the U.S., your family eventually joined you here, right?
Yes. Yeah.
You went to law school.
Yeah.
You were a very successful person, going to law school, becoming a successful attorney, marrying another successful attorney. You've had some good years since you've been in the U.S.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, once I left Virginia and went to college and then law school, it was much better because the high school years were not good for me.
Why?
I think there were many reasons. One is that I came at a very awkward age, 13. And I think, as Harlan mentioned, you know, it was interesting that she also entered high school at 13, right? So we had that kind of like a serpent swallowing its tail coming full circle sort of feeling. I think 13 is a very difficult age, 13, 14, 15, 16. And I entered the U.S. at that age and had to go to high school right away at the beginning. So I didn't feel like I had a dress rehearsal of learning about the American educational system by going first through middle school and sort of dipping my toes into the water first. So there was a lot of pressure because my parents expected me to do very well in high school. And I was also told that all your grades in high school determine whether you go to college and elsewhere. So I was under high pressure, and I didn't know anything about the American high school experience, any of the rituals. I was just learning the language and was very awkward. And I also think that we came to Virginia, which is right outside Washington, D.C., and a lot of Vietnamese ended up going there on purpose because of its proximity to the capital city, which they associated with Saigon. And Saigon meant safety because usually in a war, the capital city is the one that's most defended from the enemy. So they felt like if they were in Virginia, right outside DC, they would be most protected. And because there were so many Vietnamese there, I think that a lot of the people in my high school and in that neighborhood probably felt like we were invaders. Because I've compared experiences with other friends who were like maybe the only Vietnamese family in their city, and they had a much better experience because I think the people did not feel like that there were swarms of aliens coming to change the character of their hometown. And I think that at the beginning was the feeling, at least in that area.
And did that change then in college and in your career?
I remember in college was the first time that I lived in a dorm with and had any meal with American friends. So I went through high school very isolated. And when I got to college, which was a wonderful college, very, very loving, very supportive, Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts, and I chose it just accidentally, turned out to be a great choice. It was very close to where Fritz, the American who came to pick me up from Vietnam. So his wife would visit me every weekend. So yeah, college was a great experience, very eye-opening, very supportive. And I think I thrived in college, and it gave me a lot of confidence that I didn't have as in high school.
That a lot of people don't have in high school,
yeah.
As a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Yeah. You revisited Vietnam as a young adult, as I recall. How old were you when you went back? And tell me, what surprised you? Because you were seeing your homeland as an outsider for the first time. What surprised you when you went back?
I went back in 91, and I went back under the auspices of from a Ford Foundation grant. And I did that on purpose because I didn't want it to be my first trip back to be a personal odyssey. So I made sure that it was wrapped under the mantle of a professional move. So I went there through the Ford Foundation to study emerging economies, because at that time, the Soviet Union had collapsed, and there were a lot of questions as to whether or not communist countries would stay communist, or they would be like Eastern Europe, becoming market economies. So I went to Vietnam to study that and to make connections with Vietnamese lawyers. So it was purely professional. But of course, when you go there, there's going to be a personal a feeling to it. And it was I was very nervous, and my parents were very nervous because they were afraid that I would not be able to leave. And it was fine. It was a very good experience, but bittersweet, because I realized the moment I got there that all the Vietnamese whom I came into contact with could tell that I did not grow up in Vietnam. So, you know, by the way I moved, even before I spoke Vietnamese, they could tell that I had been one of the ones that left and was returning. So it was bittersweet, because it made me realize that I wasn't really from there anymore. Mm. And a lot of times when I'm in the U.S., even if I've assimilated, I don't fully feel like I'm from here either. So going to Vietnam and realizing that I don't really have any real roots there anymore, it's more just by a historical record that I would say I'm Vietnamese, but not really, because people there didn't see me as that either, which confirmed for me my alienation when I was there.
And you've just confirmed what I said earlier about how beautifully you were able to stand back and look at something so personal and so emotional in a lot of ways, but describe it with a perspective that a lot of us can try to understand and try to appreciate.
I think everybody probably wants to have a home. And I think that quest is probably more pronounced for refugees. But it's not only a refugee journey. Everybody wants that. So in that way, you know, I want it to be the story to be evocative in a way that, although it's personal, it can expand outward and speak to other people who are not refugees, because we have very similar human emotions.
Yeah, exactly. And you're right. Everybody wants to feel at home in some way, somewhere.
Yeah.
Harlan, you went to Vietnam for the first time at what age?
6 and a half.
Was it as it had been described to you? Were you surprised by any of it, or was it exactly what Lan had told you?
She didn't really talk about its physical traits when, as I was growing up, that I can remember. I knew she was Vietnamese because there was like 100 cousins that were all speaking Vietnamese, and it was clear like they had come from somewhere else. But you know, when you're a child, you know, you see the world totally differently. So I just saw these people are a lot taller than me. They speak a different language. I'm a little bit intimidated because a lot of them look very severe. Because I guess they're all traumatized in their own way. And they've all gone through a lot to get to the point where they can have this beautiful house. And that's how I kind of saw it. But she never said, you know, I mean, I asked a lot of questions. You know, I was at the age where it's like, but why this? And she didn't ever describe, like, there was a church and there was this, or I can imagine now that even when she's asked about Vietnam, she gets very emotional, and it's been much longer since the time I was 6, so I'm sure back then it was still really raw, like a wound, and now I think it's still just like slightly scabbing, so it's emotionally the way, that's why she didn't tell me. But when I got there, I remember just for some reason I just thought elephants were everywhere roaming free in Asia. So I was like, there must be so many elephants on the street. That was my one disappointment. Everything else was beautiful.
How many elephants did you find?
None. And we don't go to zoos because I feel bad for the animals. So I didn't see any elephants. And she put me in a nun's school.
A Catholic.
It was a Catholic school with kids. And the one thing, you know, she would teach me phrases in Vietnamese. I kind of had the accent down, but she was like, this is how you say, you know, go play, I need help, you know, I'm your friend, teacher, you know, call this woman that out of respect. but I had no idea that you were not allowed to not finish the food that they give you, because I didn't know, I didn't like it, and I also wasn't used to like nap time on the bamboo yoga mat, and I wasn't sleepy, so I didn't finish my food. And I remember there was a kid who earlier that day I had seen step on a dragonfly, like a baby, just for no reason. And I don't know why I was so violent as a child, but I hit him really hard. And I think he was really upset. And I was like six still. So later he saw me not finish my food, and he had told one of the teachers, and they took my hand and slapped it with a ruler. And I was so shocked. I was like, oh my God, that was my one surprise. But everything else was super peaceful. I mean, even with the shakiness of the war, I feel like you can kind of see it on a lot of people's faces, especially if I see like a 9-year-old woman on the street, I'm like, God, you must have seen literally everything possible in your life. But, you know, it's a very sweet, gentle culture. I mean, even like the hats, the cloth, like the dresses that all the women wear, it's just elegant. It's just the way it is. There's nothing over the top. Everything's very minimalist. It was very calming. And I turned 7 there, and she had even hired a violin teacher while I was there. And
I was a great teacher.
I became very attached to the violin teacher. I remember when it was like her last day to leave, I stood in the elevator doors and I was like, you can't go. So it was very sweet.
You mentioned learning a few words of Vietnam and Vietnamese, and knowing the basics just enough to get you through the classroom. This is a very good time for you, one or the other, to explain the title of the book, Family in Six Tones.
Yeah. So the Vietnamese alphabet uses the same letters as the English language. Some of them are different, like D, like the D is pronounced like a Z or a Y in the South, unless there's a cross through it. So the little things like that are different, but there are 6 markings, just like, they're really simple. And sometimes if you put certain ones over different vowels vowels in Vietnamese, it changes the meaning of the word, because it determines how you carry your voice. You know, if it goes up, then you kind of carry it up, down, you know, it totally changes the meaning. So there's the literal version of like, okay, it's Vietnamese themed. But then also,
yeah, because it's 6 tones.
Those are the tones. Okay.
Yeah. So there are 6 tones.
But also growing up, I think I learned a lot about communication and like observing the people that you love in your family. And we would get into a lot of fights when I was little, because she'd say, you know, it's the way you say things that matters. It's the tone of your voice. It's that little tweak in the Vietnamese language can change something from mom to ghost, which is like harmless most of the time in communication, but there are other things that could deeply offend somebody in the culture, that if you say the wrong thing, it's all about like the fragility, I guess, of human relationships and life. And you could also think, you know, like the butterfly effect. I don't know if you know what that is, but little moment that Gwyneth Paltrow movie Sliding Doors, it shows her 2 different realities based on one second. Did she miss the train? Did she not miss the train? And it's very similar. It like makes you appreciate the moment. It's caused, actually knowing about that has caused some anxiety for me, because I have like some, you know, what if that could have happened, or what if I do this now, what will happen? And so, but I think that the title can both be taken literally.
Yeah. So, you know, like it's 6 tones. So it represents the fact that this is a memoir that involves Vietnam. And then as Harlan said, you know, it evokes the complexity of the musical notes that are in human relationships, right? Like some notes can be of the major key, and that has a major tone. And then if you change just a few notes, and Vietnamese is very musical, it becomes a minor key, and that creates a totally different relationship, a mood. So in many ways, you know, our communication, whether it's Vietnamese or not, can be very much influenced by these marks that one bring into the relationship. So in our case, it's the diacritical mark, but marks of the past, marks of the future, expectations, all these marks that are tones affect families and relationships. So that's what we were trying to impart with that title. which our editor came up with. Neither one of us came up with that. Yeah. Our editor came up with Family in Six Tones, which I really loved.
Standing back and having the perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to ask about a situation of Harlan. And it has to do with the effects of trauma in your family. And it's a story that you wrote. It doesn't show up until, what, about halfway through the book. Your dad was still alive at the time. You were a pretty little kid. And you found your mom in the bathroom on the floor. Can you tell us what was happening?
So I think, you know, up until the way I describe it, the part that I think is the most shocking for readers was the part that was most shocking for me in the moment. But the part leading up to it was very soothing, because I'm not going to go in too much into what it is because I get really emotional. But, you know, there's a part where I'm talking to my mom. It's very sweet. I feel the same age as, I feel that we're the same age. And then suddenly she kind of turns, you know, and I wrote the first part to show that it's not a bad thing. I don't want there to be any stigma about trauma. It was very sweet to grow up that way. I always appreciate it. But trauma is trauma. So I think a part of her still resented the fact that she had to take it. Resented, I don't know who she resented, but she resented. I'm sorry. But it was clear that there was a lot of anger and built up inside of her. It's almost as if you're bleeding out. You know, like when sometimes in movies you see someone get shot and the blood comes out of their mouth. And it's surprising, like it's all coming out, their soul kind of disappears. It's the same, but with her feelings. And it's so heavy that it takes a physical effect. And, you know, psychiatrists say this all the time, like I went through a period where I was really numb emotionally, but my headaches were so bad because my body was trying to show me it was sad by like making my arm hurt, my face hurt, everything. And it was clear that my dad knew about it. And I think he loved her because, I mean, obviously, you know, you love somebody, you want to take care of them. But I think when you know that somebody needs your help, a part of you likes to be appreciated and needed. And he was very good at taking care of her. I think I would have had a much, much more issues growing up from it if he hadn't been there. But again, I didn't see it as a burden. Maybe I would prefer, I think there are parts of my personality that I would prefer not there that might be there because of things like that. But I think it's still, I think that those bad parts kind of help my good parts become good. So I think it's okay.
And you've become a protector of your mom since then as well.
Yeah, I think so. It doesn't always feel that way because sometimes growing up, like, not that I resented it, but I felt like I needed a mom a lot. And she was a very good teacher because she's so smart and so educated, because that was her way of getting out of the war, right? Like education. But I always thought, you know, she's a great teacher. She's a good protector, but the mothering part, the emotional relating to your child was difficult because we were so different. And I felt I could relate to her in a way because I understood her, because I saw it growing up. I saw, even like at four, you know, when you see your mom hurting herself in a way because she's trying to take care of herself, but she can't do it without hurting herself. You see it all. And I grew up to be very observant, reading, you know, art. What does this mean? Like, how do you see people? We're going to watch Woody Allen movies and analyze human relationships, stuff like that. So I was really protective of her. I think I saw her a lot the way she was. And I, at the time, I mean, I liked it. And then, you know, when you go into high school, and I write about this, you know, when you're 14, 15, and you've learned a lot, for me, those things couldn't help me make any friends because I, like, no one can relate to that. And I didn't really know how to make friends. So that's where I kind of lost touch of seeing myself taking care of her. I think I resented her during that time. But the book helped me find it back.
and very nicely explained. I'm going to respect what I heard you telling us, that this is not really the time to talk in depth about it. I'll just ask our readers to take a look at what's in the book. You'll understand immediately as you read from start to finish what we're talking about, why the detail of it is just too emotional to talk about right here, and we'll respect that. We'll just say that trauma has, for now, we'll just say that trauma has its effects. It had a very rough effect on your family, and you make it through. You're continuing to make it through and doing very nicely with it. And we'll leave it at that.
You know, I want to just add something briefly, which is that one of our fights about what we're going to include in the book actually is about that. Because I was very hesitant to include anything about trauma in that type of way, right?
Right.
Not in sort of a general way, but I relinquished my control because when Harlan really wanted to write about it, I didn't feel like I could tell her that she can't write about her own experience, right? Because it's what she saw. So not that I said, okay, if you really want to write about that, then you can write about it. And then I will maybe respond in my own way in my chapter. And I didn't want the writing to be about constraint for her. I want writing to be about freedom, which is what it's been for me, as a means of expression where nobody can tell you what you can write and what you cannot write. Because if you were in a tyrannical country, the government would tell you what you can and cannot write, right? So I didn't want to be the parent who acts as the government, prohibiting her from having her First Amendment, so to speak, right to think and write whatever she wants. But also, she convinced me that it's probably a good thing to deal with some of the mental health issues and to put it out there so that it could be destigmatized. And because it's in the book, I also felt like I need to show how it had been a process for me. So, you know, in that way, therapy becomes a very important part of the book as well, which is how stepping out of your own fear and your own maybe embarrassment and taking the plunge and going into therapy is actually a very positive step. So you need to find a therapist who can be there for you.
I think as people read the book and understand a little bit more what played out in your family as an effect of trauma, we also start to realize that maybe we don't know anyone who has been through what you've been through, but we see little pieces of other people we know in you, and mm-hmm. we relate in some way. So it's very effective and a very important piece of the memoir that you've given us. So it's thank you for allowing Harlan to write about it, because it was very useful, I think will be to a lot of people. Harlan, you have a goal in your career to be a writer, but to be a different kind of writer. It's not necessarily books that you want to stick with.
Yeah, part of me wishes that I wanted to, because I think the fact that I want to do movies stresses me out a lot, because to be honest, I already have the literary connections, and it's not something where you're like, oh, what's the budget? I have to find somebody to act. I have to figure out a script. Like, writing for me is the easiest thing ever. I love it so much. The only thing I'm insecure about, and the reason why I never read back my writing ever, is the description and like the prose, I guess. Maybe I'm more insecure because the book that I just wrote is literally just about myself. But I love writing dialogue, because I think, even though I think there's other ways to communicate other than words, it's so interesting to me how a script is only dialogue, and then you see the movie and it's insane the stuff that they added in. So I think it really is like an art form. And a lot of the stuff that have mattered to me the most have come from like that movie Blackfish. I always use that as an example, because it really opened people's eyes to orca whales and how they're being captured at SeaWorld the abuse and everything. And I'm sure, like, if you thought about it, you would understand that that's the case. But to see it in a movie, and it's not, like, too much of a documentary, it's not in your face, it's, like, a subtle thing that creates empathy. I think movies are really good for making empathy, and it's really important to me.
Now, I saw an interview that the two of you did together with some other interviewer. I saw an interview that you did where, Lon, you said that you write because books meant so much to you as a reader. But in that same interview, Harlan, you said that you and your friends don't necessarily take part in recreational reading. How will your writing be affected by not being an avid reader?
Yeah, I think first of all, my generation, just the iPhone, we grew up, you know, I got my phone when I was like 10, which is the normal age for everybody. And so that's your entertainment. There was no need to read, you know? And so they would, there's a movie on your phone, so they just prefer that. I think I would adapt to that by, I think film would be my way of adapting to that. The only other thing is I am working on a novel right now, but I'm hoping that I could somehow work that out into a TV show if I could. Because I look at the stuff my friends watch and what means a lot to them and everything. It's really remarkable because the stuff that they love, I don't think they realize, is totally a mirror of their own lives in a different way. It's just portrayed dramatically, so everyone's like, that's crazy, but it's really not. It's the way that you, it could be a movie just about a boyfriend and a girlfriend, the girlfriend's mom is divorcing the dad, and everyone thinks it's so intense, but I'm looking at all of them, I'm like, you're literally going through this right now. So just make the connection, and just taking inspiration. I feel like I'm slowly spying on them to write this thing, but I think that's how I'm going to probably adapt.
So now that you've said that, it makes sense. Lon, as an avid reader, found her way to express herself in books. You, as a movie lover, are finding a way to express yourself in writing film, in writing scripts. So that does make sense. You are taking in the medium that inspires you. Yeah. There's a lot of mission, Lon, in what you write. Mission as helping us to understand a refugee perspective, helping us to understand what it was like to come to this country and other effects as well. And also a mission in letting us know how it is to be a mom. How do you inspire that mission in your daughter?
Well, I don't know if I'm even successful at doing that, you know, because we've, as I said, you know, we've had a lot of ups and downs. And I think my mission in writing is very much to present not ideas, you know, because ideas are too abstract, is to tell a story that is emotionally touching. And that could even include writing about a antagonist who is emotionally empathetic. So I have some Viet Cong characters in my novels that I don't paint as a straw man. So to that extent, when I want to talk to Harlan about something, I usually tell her a story about, you know, I don't just tell her, don't do this or don't do that, because I can tell that she's zoning out the moment I'm before I even open my mouth. But I feel like if I bring in a story, you know, about an animal, because we're both very drawn to animals, for example. Any story about, let's say, how to be a steward for the environment, right? Because we are also very concerned about the environment. And I bring in, let's say, what's happening to an animal, and I find a story about a particular animal that is suffering from climate change. Then I tell her that story, and then she relates to it the way I would tell a story if it were in a novel. So rather than just say, this is what you should be or this is what you shouldn't be, as she was growing up, I was always telling her stories. And I found in my own way that stories basically saved my life, right? One of my favorite stories is 1001 Arabian Night, and it's literally about a woman who told stories so that she wouldn't be decapitated by the king. So stories have always been very powerful to me. And I think stories make you relate to the characters and to the ideas, because the ideas are embodied in people. And they're not just abstract ideas, because if they're abstract ideas, they can be didactic. So when I teach Harlan things, I always try to make them stories, and I try to do it as a mother telling a story rather than imparting lessons. I don't know if I'm successful, but that's my approach with her as she's been growing up.
Lan Cao and Harlan Margaret Van Cao, co-authors of Family in Six Tones. Our podcast is produced by Jen Picard. Our recording and technical team included Tashina Brito, Antonio Munoz, James Tejada, and Mark Jones. The executive producer is Joe Barr. Our theme song is from Pond 5. You can find more information about the authors and books online, capradio.org/reads. Keep up with our latest conversations by subscribing to Cap Radio Reads on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. While you're at it, check out our other podcasts. Find them at capradio.org/podcasts. I'm Nana Epidone. Thanks for listening to Cap Radio Reads from Capital Public Radio.